Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Isn't it fascinating to contemplate how the world changes? 25 years ago, we saw the first CDs replace those large vinyl discs we used to call LPs. 50 years ago, the space age really began with the launch of Sputnik, the first satellite, followed by Laika the dog. And at about the same time, out in the desert in South Australia, the British were exploding bombs, atomic bombs, something that may come as a surprise to younger listeners. Alan Parkinson has written a book about all this and about what happened next. It's called Maralinga, Australia's Nuclear Waste Cover-Up.
Most people living in Australia today probably do not know that 12 atomic bombs have been exploded on Australian territory. 7 of those bombs were exploded at Maralinga in South Australia in the 1950s. Following those explosions, Britain conducted a series of experiments in which they exploded another 15 bombs in a manner which precluded an atomic explosion. Those experiments spread plutonium and uranium over hundreds of square kilometres of the South Australian landscape. Before they abandoned the site, the British conducted a final clean-up in 1967, and the Australian government accepted their assurance that Maralinga was clean. In the mid-1980s, scientists from the Australian Radiation Laboratory surveyed the site and found it was far from satisfactory. In 1989, I prepared estimates for some 30 options for cleaning the site, ranging from simply fencing the contaminated area to scraping over 100 square kilometres of land and burying the contaminated soil. The federal government agreed with the South Australian government and the Maralinga Jarraja to implement a partial clean-up. This partial clean-up was to be in two parts. The first was to scrape up and bury the most contaminated soil. The second part was to treat 21 pits containing thousands of tonnes of plutonium-contaminated debris by a process of vitrification, which would immobilise the plutonium for perhaps a million years. In 1993, I was appointed a member of the Maralinga Rehabilitation Technical Advisory Committee, whose purpose was to advise the minister on progress of the project, and a few months later, I was appointed the government's representative to oversee the whole project. By the end of 1997, the collection and burial of contaminated soil was nearing an end. However, as that soil was scraped up, we found the state of the 21 debris pits was not at all what we had been led to believe from the British reports. The pits were very much larger than the British reports told us, with about 3 times as much debris as we had expected, and therefore treatment by vitrification would clearly cost a lot more. By then we had completed a 3-year programme to match the vitrification technology to the Maralinga geology, and a company called Geosafe had built the equipment ready to use it to treat the pits. Unfortunately, when the department signed the contract with Geosafe, they failed to include that most basic feature of any contract, a statement of what had to be achieved. The equipment was tested in Adelaide before being taken to site, and those tests, which I witnessed, showed that the technology was going to be just as successful as we had hoped. It was at this time that the department held 3 meetings with a company that had no knowledge at all of the vitrification technology. They had not been involved in the 3-year development program, and nobody from that company had even seen the full-size equipment. Similarly, the 2 attendees from the department had no knowledge of the technology or any project management experience. Add to that, nobody in those meetings had any nuclear expertise or experience in the disposal of nuclear waste. Even though I was the government's representative overseeing the whole project, I was excluded, as was Geosafe. The department then proposed to appoint this company as project manager and project authority over the vitrification part of the project. I resisted this and advised them not to proceed along this path. GeoSafe also objected, telling the department several times in writing and face-to-face that the company was not qualified to take over the project, having no knowledge at all of what was involved. The department persisted and, against all advice, appointed the company. For my pains, I was removed from the project and the advisory committee. I was sacked. So the world's experts in the vitrification technology found themselves contracted to the department, but reporting to a company that knew nothing about the technology. In turn, that company reported to people in the department who were similarly ignorant of the technology, had no nuclear expertise, and no project management experience. From that point on, the project was almost certainly likely to fail. Within a few weeks of being appointed, the new project managers put forward a proposal that some of the pits should be exhumed and their contents buried, claiming this would be cheaper. The department accepted the suggestion and introduced what they call the hybrid system, a mixture of dubious practice and the best available technology. And I maintain they did this merely to save money. In fact, later when Mr. Peter McGoran inherited the project, he tried to defend a saving of over $5 million. Vitrification of some pits continued until, as treatment was nearing completion on one pit, there was a huge explosion within the pit. The steel hood over the pit was extensively damaged and molten glass was spewed some 50 metres from the pit. Fortunately, nobody was injured in the incident, but it gave the government an excuse to cancel vitrification altogether. They then exhumed all the pits, including those that had been vitrified, and placed the whole lot in a shallow grave and covered it. In March 2000, Senator Minchin visited Maralinga and declared the site was safe and could be returned to the Aborigines. He was accompanied on that visit by Dr. John Loy, the head of the Australian Radiation Protection and Nuclear Safety Agency, ARPANSA. Dr. Loy went on to claim that the shallow burial of plutonium-contaminated debris was world's best practice. 3 years later, on the 25th of March 2003, Mr. McGoran tabled the government's final report of the project in Parliament. In his speech, he said, "The project achieved its goals and a world best practice result," oblivious to the fact that a partial clean-up cannot, by definition, be world's best practice. It would be a pity if the only record of the project was that published by the government. That final report contains so many incorrect statements that it cannot be said to describe what really happened on the project. And now, 7 years after the government claimed the project a success, and 4 years after Mr. McGoran's declaration, it is time to put a few things into perspective and look back on how the project was managed and what it bodes for the future. In this, I am mindful of the Prime Minister's push towards nuclear power. Dr. Swikowski's inquiry drew attention to three things that are relevant to the Maralinga project. The first is for there to be an independent nuclear regulator. The Maralinga project was halfway through its final phase when ARPANSA was born. The second is the need to recruit scientists and engineers with experience in the nuclear industry. The last phase of the Maralinga project was managed by a company with no nuclear expertise, reporting to a client similarly devoid of nuclear experiences and, in some cases, no technical knowledge. And the third is the problem of nuclear waste disposal. The minister and the chief nuclear regulator claim the shallow burial of plutonium to be world's best practice. So why does the rest of the world not follow suit? Why do they insist that long-lived nuclear waste, such as that at Maralinga, should be disposed of in a deep geological facility? In August 2003, I visited Sellafield in northern England. That is where the plutonium now spread across a huge area of South Australia originated. There, People with far more experience in dealing with plutonium place plutonium-contaminated material in stainless steel drums and store those drums in an air-conditioned building on a guarded site, awaiting permanent deep geological disposal. It is the same story in America, where trials similar to those at Maralinga were conducted, except on a much smaller scale. In their cleanup, the Americans bagged the contaminated soil and debris and transported the whole lot over 300 kilometres to a nuclear waste storage facility on a guarded site. Those countries clearly do not agree that burial of plutonium in a shallow grave with no packaging and in totally unsuitable geology is world's best practice. In July 2001, the government published a document called Safe Storage of Radioactive Waste, which says that long-lived, low and intermediate level waste is not suitable for shallow burial. And yet that is what has been done at Maralinga and claimed to be world's best practice. And the government puts similar spin on other features of the project. In his speech to Parliament, Mr. McGoran said the cleanup would permit unrestricted access to about 90% of the 3,200 square kilometre Maralinga site. But there was unrestricted access to 90% of the site before the project started. The only additional area in which there is unrestricted access is half a square kilometre. Admittedly, another 1.6 square kilometres have been cleaned, but that is within the area to which access is restricted. And one part of that restricted area is 300 times more contaminated than the cleanup criteria. In truth, after spending $108 million, less than 2% of the land contaminated above the cleanup criteria has been cleaned. I'm not criticising that. It was what was planned, but let us keep it in perspective. Anybody listening to the government statements might be under the impression that the whole site is now clean and all the plutonium used in those British trials has been buried. In fact, almost 85% of the original 24,000 grams of plutonium remains on the surface. In 24,000 years' time, half of that plutonium will still be there. But in about 400 years from now, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to detect it. On my last visit to Maralinga, in September 1999, I was farewelled with, well, see you in February for the handover. I have heard many times that the site will be returned later in the year or in the next few months, and 7 years later, I am still waiting for that event. Will the Aborigines accept return of their land? If they do, then for thousands of years, they will have to rely on the federal government to honour any agreements they might enter, in full knowledge that only a few years ago, the government unilaterally broke their agreement to clean the site using the best available technology and then failed to do so.
Nuclear engineer Alan Parkinson, who lives in Canberra. His book, Maralinga, Australia's Nuclear Waste Cover-Up, is published by the ABC. Next week, Ockham's Razor comes from the University of Notre Dame in Perth, where Simon Adams is Executive Dean of Arts and Sciences. And its title is King Kong, Charles Darwin and the Irish Fenians. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.